Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 152 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. Listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember, you'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know you're a listener till I hear from you, so if you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth to make monthly donations. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting future guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. And now let's go to this week's guest. Neil Miller is a medical research journalist and the director of the Think Twice Global Vaccine Institute. He's devoted the past 30 years to educating parents and health practitioners about vaccines, encouraging informed consent and non-mandatory vaccine laws. He's the author of several articles, studies, and books on vaccines, including Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, which is the reason I'm interviewing him today, Vaccine Safety Manual for Concerned Families and Health Practitioners, and Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? Past organizations he's lectured for include the International Chiropractic Pediatric Association, the International College of Integrative Medicine, the Hahnemann Academy of North America, and the Culture of Life Institute. He has a degree in psychology. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, first, tell us how you became concerned about vaccine recommendations, especially for children.
Well, when my own children were going to be born, when my wife was pregnant with our first child, I felt that it was my responsibility to investigate vaccines and to determine whether or not that was something that my wife and I were going to be interested in doing. And so I began at the time we didn't really have the internet, so I was doing most of my research at medical libraries.
And when was this, approximately?
Back in the 1980s.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there weren't many people actually speaking out about vaccines. Barbara Lowe Fisher with the National Vaccine Information Center had a child that was hurt by the DPT vaccine, mm-hmm. and so she had begun her organization to inform people about the dangers of that vaccine. But other than that, there wasn't really anyone else. Dr. Mendelsohn had written a few papers on problems with vaccines, and he was a pediatrician, so he was significant, but he mm-hmm. didn't document anything. He didn't, you know, he would make his claims, which was important at the time, but he wasn't really documenting with any citations or anything like that. But I was doing my research for, you know, for personal reasons, and I had collected and a lot of different types of information, and I was astounded by what I was discovering. In many cases, vaccines were unsafe and ineffective. And I started to put that information together. And, of course, my wife and I, we decided against vaccinating our children. Mm-hmm. But everything snowballed from there. People started to contact me. They found out about the information I had gathered. And so it eventually was organized into a booklet and then eventually into a book. And that was my first book, Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective?
Right.
A Parent's Guide to Childhood Shots, and that book has been printed and reprinted many, many times and translated into numerous languages around the world, and it's sold more than 250,000 copies, and it's still going pretty strong. But everything snowballed from that, and before I knew it, I was being asked to speak out on this topic, to give lectures, and then I continued to do more extensive research, and I've written several books since then. Vaccine Safety Manual is an important book. It's over 350 pages of information about each individual vaccine and the diseases associated with them. But my most recent book is Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies. I got tired of listening to doctors telling parents that there are no studies and that there's no scientific evidence of any kind that vaccines are unsafe or ineffective.
Okay,
so
well,
I decided.
Yeah, and I've done quite a bit of scientific research in other areas, not so much with vaccines, but HIV/AIDS, things like that. And, you know, I think I started accumulating scientific papers for much the same reason. Everybody would say, everybody knows HIV causes AIDS, it's well documented. When you actually look at it, it's not. And you've basically tried to answer that same question, where many people who probably, if you're pro-vaccine, you don't ever have had to read a single scientific paper, will say there's just no evidence that of any harm. So here's a paper from your book. Baby monkeys that were given vaccines according to the U.S. vaccination schedule had abnormalities in the region of the brain affecting social, economic, and emotional development from 2010 by Hewitson. So what can you say about that and the U.S. vaccination schedule?
Well, I mean, that was an important study that came out just a few years ago. And that study was designed to investigate structural and functional changes in the developing infant primate brain following the administration of U.S. pediatric vaccines according to the recommended childhood schedule. So in other words, these researchers wanted to determine whether giving vaccines to primates in the same doses that are being given to infant children would cause any kinds of problems. And what they discovered was that these primates had different types of conditions in their brain that mimicked autism in children. So,
one of the criticisms could be that, okay, you gave the same dose as children, but monkeys are smaller.
Well, the doses were modified to the weight of the primates.
But in humans, that's not the case, right? A preemie gets the same dose. Like, I was over 10 pounds at birth. So if I'd been born today, I would have got the same dose as a baby a quarter of my weight in the pediatric intensive care unit.
Yeah, that would have been perhaps a little bit safer for you as a 10-pound infant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But for a premature infant that is, four, five, six pounds at birth, they're giving the hepatitis B vaccine to that infant. At 2 months of age, according to the CDC's recommended immunization schedule, babies are expected to receive 8 vaccines concurrently. And some babies weigh considerably less than other babies, and so they're not getting equal doses, and those babies are definitely more susceptible. And I have actually conducted a study that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. I conducted this study with Dr. Gary Goldman, and our study is summarized in this book, Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, where we summarized over 400 studies that are critical of vaccines. And in our study, we found that babies that are younger are statistically significantly more likely to be hospitalized or die than babies that are older when they receive these vaccines. And I'm talking about infants. So, for example, right. infants that receive multiple vaccines simultaneously when they're younger infants, say, you know, anywhere from birth to 6 months of age, are statistically significantly more likely to be hospitalized or die than older infants, infants that are 6 months to 1 year of age. We also found that giving multiple vaccines simultaneously is a dangerous practice. We found that when you give 8 vaccines simultaneously, as recommended by the CDC, a baby is statistically significantly more likely to be hospitalized or die than a baby that receives 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2 vaccines simultaneously.
These seem very minor critiques, basically saying that, you know, you should take into account the body weight of a child, you should take into account the immune reaction of each vaccine and not overdo it by having too many at a time. But, I mean, what's the reaction of the medical establishment to suggestions that we should not vaccinate preemies and we should not do multiple vaccinations?
Well, they either ignore the evidence and or they continue with business as usual. The CDC, in our study by Dr. Goldman and myself, we confirmed that the CDC's recommended immunization schedule is not based on scientific evidence. It's based on convenience. They put together this immunization schedule because it's more convenient for parents to come in fewer times to the pediatrician to give their infants these vaccines. When these vaccines go through their clinical trials and the FDA okays the vaccine and licenses the vaccine, Each vaccine is looked at individually, but they are not looked at in combination. So they've never looked at them to see what happens when you give 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 vaccines at the same time. And what we discovered is that there's a synergistic toxicity. And anybody knows this. Mm-hmm. Any chemist, anybody that deals with combinations of vaccines or drugs, and by the way, a vaccine is a drug, they know that when you give 2 drugs simultaneously, or 3 or 4 drugs, the potential for additive or synergistic toxicity increases.
Yeah, it's so, only in mathematics that 1 + 1 = 2. If you put 2 drugs together, you may get a whole lot more than 2. They may combat each other, so the beneficial effect of one drug may be countered by another. This is well known in medicine, and as you say, in drugs, but vaccines are generally treated as if they weren't drugs.
And it's not just that one drug may counter the other, it's that one drug may potentiate the other. When we think of synergistic, we have to think of exponential. So it's not just like 1 + 1 = 2. We're talking exponential potential for adverse reactions. And our study confirmed that. So we found that the CDC, in my research has led me to many studies that are based on fraudulent intentions, and there's actual outright corruption involved. In fact, the last chapter of my book, Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, is entirely on conflicts of interest and fraudulent studies. Dr. John Ioannidis,
right.
is an expert on the analysis of studies, and he is well respected around the world. And he has said, through his studies, he has shown that more than half of all studies within the biomedical sciences are false.
Well, let's talk about one pretty controversial study, study number 6 in your book. And it's, your book is titled 400 Important Scientific Papers, but it's actually a little bit more than 400. But so number 6 is by a guy named Vere Stratton from 2000, and you describe it as infants who received vaccines containing mercury developed speech disorders, sleep disorders, and autism. But you also note that this study was not published. So how did you get a copy of this?
I have access to a lot of information. I've been doing the research for so many years that I have so many resources. Now, this was a study. It's interesting that you bring this up because it goes to confirm exactly what I just said, that the CDC is really a marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industry. This is what I have discovered. Mm-hmm. Okay, they are in bed with the pharmaceutical titans, and this was a study. This study by Vere Stratton. Vere Stratton was a CDC epidemiologist.
Mm-hmm.
17 years ago, in the year 2000, the CDC conducted its own study to determine whether mercury in vaccines is dangerous to children. And what they discovered was that when babies are given mercury-containing vaccines, they are 5 times more likely to develop a non-organic sleep disorder, and they were 7.6 times more likely to develop autism when compared to infants who were unexposed to mercury
right.
from thimerosal-containing vaccines. So here we have a study that was conducted by the CDC. The CDC's own lead epidemiologist was the lead researcher on this study.
Mm-hmm.
They determined that mercury was absolutely detrimental to infants and to children. And what they did with this study was they buried it. Instead
right.
of warning the nation, instead of warning the world that they had discovered that mercury was dangerous, and they begin to implement steps to take mercury out of these vaccines.
Which is interesting, because they never really said publicly, yes, mercury is dangerous in vaccine. The implication
no, they said
is
just the opposite. Just
yeah.
the opposite. They say that mercury is safe, that there's no problem with mercury.
But we're
and
taking it out anyway, just because a bunch of parents are whining about it.
But even, exactly, but even today, they continue to deny that there's any evidence that mercury in vaccines is dangerous. There's more than 175 studies, more than 175 peer-reviewed papers that show mercury is dangerous.
Well, mercury now, here's, is being and here, removed out of, mercury was heavily used in medicine. It was used as a treatment for syphilis. It was used in teething powders, and one after the other, the world finally realized that this was incredibly dangerous, particularly causing neurological illnesses. Mercury was even used in skin lighteners used by black-skinned people to try to obtain a lighter skin, but it caused, I believe, kidney failure was the problem with that use of mercury. But in vaccines, mercury still safe.
Well, that's what they're trying to convince us of, despite 165 peer-reviewed studies that show otherwise, and despite the CDC's own study that confirmed that mercury in vaccines is dangerous. So I have the abstract to this study. This was a study that actually was presented at a conference, but then they decided that they were not going to publish the full study. I suppose they didn't like the results, and there were a lot of ramifications if they were to present this
information. I mean, not only
instead they decided to bury this study.
Right. I mean, they have two risks, right? Not only do they have to remove mercury from all vaccines, probably, but they would have potentially been on the line. Somebody would have been on the line for lawsuits, presumably, right?
Well,
so it's a double whammy.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. That's one reason. One reason that they continue to deny is because the compensation to all of the people that have been damaged would essentially bankrupt our country.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I believe, is why Congress is refusing to do anything about it. The other reason is that they are rightfully concerned that they know that if people were to become aware of this information, they would lose faith in the CDC. And they should. They should lose faith in the CDC because the CDC is just a corrupt organization right now, in my opinion. In my research, there are many, many studies that I've seen that were performed by the CDC that are fraudulent, and it appears to be intentional in many cases. And I just gave one example of where they clearly came up with results that showed that the vaccine program was damaging our babies, and yet they denied it, and the choice that they made was to continue with business as usual. Now, the CDC claimed that they were removing mercury from vaccines. They said that, and it wasn't just the CDC, but it was the American Academy of Pediatrics and the FDA. They all touted this as big news that they had removed mercury from vaccines in 1999. But I wrote a paper that was recently published, mm-hmm. and it's a paper on the dangers of aluminum in vaccines.
Right, which and I want to talk about.
Okay, it's an important paper. And in that paper, I briefly touch on the removal of mercury from vaccines. I still hear today people say, why do we even talk about mercury in vaccines anymore when it was removed? Well, here's what actually happened. In 1999, they said that they were going to begin the process of removing,
mm-hmm.
but they allowed all existing stock of thimerosal-containing vaccines to be used up.
Right.
They didn't want the manufacturers to lose any money.
Which is a small loss by comparison to the compensation they might have to pay. But still, any loss is of the corporations is not in the interest of the CDC.
Well, if they were acknowledging that mercury might be dangerous, why are they not just removing it immediately,
mm-hmm.
like an instant recall?
Right.
When you find out that a car is damaging people because it has faulty brakes, well, they take that car off the market right away.
Well, actually, the first instinct of the auto manufacturer is to try to bury the information.
Exactly, exactly. But they have you rarely hear about a recall of vaccines. It has happened on rare occasion, but
right.
Not so much like you see with childhood toys and things like that.
Cars, yeah. Every week there is a recall because of brakes, airbags, all kinds of potential problems. Even sometimes I just read about a recall by a manufacturer where the problem was theoretical in that nobody had the problem in the field, but the manufacturer had discovered it testing, so they were replacing a part, which is, you know, hopefully a responsible approach by a manufacturer. This could happen, it will happen if we leave this out in the field, and so we're replacing the part now. It'd be nice to see more of that. But
well, we've got 30,000 reports of potential adverse reactions to vaccines filed with the federal government every year,
mm-hmm.
and yet we don't see a recall on these vaccines, and yet if you have a few cases of potential damage or potential harm from a childhood toy or from some type of a drug that might be on the shelves of the pharmacies, they'll issue these recalls. But I want to get back to finish the point that I was making, was that they allowed the mercury containing vaccines to continue to be sold through the year 2002. Now, what they did simultaneous to that is, what they did is they began in 2003 and 2004, they made a new recommendation that infants are to now receive an influenza vaccine. So that, and the influenza vaccines were being shipped out in multi-dose vials. And multi-dose vials of the influenza vaccine contained mercury. So while they took mercury out of several childhood vaccines, they made a new recommendation that infants would have to receive two doses at 6 months and 7 months of age of a mercury-containing influenza vaccine. And they also made a new recommendation that pregnant women would now begin receiving influenza vaccines also containing thimerosal. So what you had here was a case where they were convincing parents that they were taking mercury out of vaccines, but they were simultaneously adding it into new recommendations. So a mother, a pregnant mother, her baby was receiving, because thimerosal crosses the placenta.
Right.
So the baby was receiving high concentration of mercury in utero, and then when that baby was born, 6 months later, that baby was receiving two doses of a influenza-containing vaccine. And another thing that happened simultaneous to this was that the content of aluminum in vaccines increased by 25%, so that in the year 2000, the pneumococcal vaccine was introduced, and that contains high concentrations of aluminum. And all babies were now receiving the aluminum-containing pneumococcal vaccine. And in 2005, the hepatitis A vaccine was added to the schedule, and that also contained high concentrations of aluminum.
Okay, well, let's stop here and let's talk a little bit about aluminum mercury. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but mercury, which is about 50% by weight of thimerosal, is a preservative, and you mentioned it's used in multi-dose vaccines, and that's because when the first dose is taken, it's possible to get contamination. So the mercury ensures that you don't get bacterial contamination of the vaccine. But aluminum is added as what they call an adjuvant, which is supposed to make the immune reaction stronger. And so there are very different reasons for adding them. But you've also documented a very significant synergistic effect between aluminum and mercury. So can you describe what that is?
Yeah, well, you explained it exactly correctly, that the mercury is added because, well, to be a little bit more specific, once a manufacturer produces a vaccine, it's cheaper to put 10 doses of a vaccine into one vial than to put one dose of a vaccine into one vial. So the manufacturer is actually saving about 15 cents per dose. And that's why they add mercury to the vaccine, because it saves 15 cents to the manufacturer. Aluminum is added because it's an irritant, and it produces what I call a neat technical trick. It tricks the body into producing more antibodies,
right?
And which doesn't really address other aspects of the immune system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's in my paper that was recently published, it's entitled "Aluminum in Childhood Vaccines is Unsafe." This is a recent paper, so it's not summarized in my recent book, Miller's Review of 400 Critical Vaccine Studies, but people can go up onto my website at thinktwice.com, and there is a link to this peer-reviewed paper. It's called "Aluminum in Childhood Vaccines is Unsafe," and in that paper I document the problems with aluminum, but I also document a study that was conducted, showing that there is a synergistic toxicity when you combine aluminum and thimerosal, and also document that the officials, the health authorities from around the world, held conferences on these toxic metals. And what came out in these conferences is that these officials, despite making these recommendations that all infants in the United States and around the world receive mercury and aluminum-containing toxic metals, they don't really understand the synergistic effects of these heavy metals, of these metals, and they don't understand them individually, and they don't understand them in combination. So you have, what you have is a case of health authorities making recommendations that are not based on any kind of evidence or science. And in this paper, I document the science, confirming that aluminum and mercury in vaccines is unsafe and should be immediately withdrawn from these vaccines.
And it's not just you, not to minimize your work, but
exactly.
In paper 35 in your book, you I've interviewed Chris Shaw before, so Shaw, I can't pronounce her name, Tom Lejenovic. They're both researchers at the University of British Columbia, and I think Chris Shaw, who's the sort of senior scientist, was a very respected aluminum researcher, but he got into trouble when he started looking at aluminum vaccines, and he had a paper withdrawn by the journal Vaccine and things like this. But here you have a study from 2013. This might be the
one. Some of these studies are summarizing Tom Lejenovic and Chris Shaw's papers.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very important researchers in this area, and I don't see how these people have an axe to grind. They're experts in aluminum. They're concerned about the amount of aluminum. So your summary, well, I just read the title of the paper, Aluminum in the Central Nervous System, Toxicity in Humans and Animals, Vaccine Adjuvants, and Autoimmunity, from 2013, as I said.
Well, my paper is essentially a review of the studies. So, for example, I've gone and I've looked at the peer-reviewed studies on aluminum, which includes Tom Lejenovic's work and Dr. Shaw's work. It includes Gerhardy's. He's a French scientist who's done a lot of important research on the problems with aluminum in vaccines. So I've essentially summarized the peer-reviewed research on the problems with aluminum in vaccines, and that's what my paper is about.
It looks like you have about 20 different papers on aluminum, about half by the Shaw Tom Genovic team, and the other half by other various authors. That's a pretty significant number.
Well, aluminum has been a problem. We've known aluminum is a problem for decades. We've known that aluminum is a problem, and like I said, the infants are receiving multiple doses of aluminum-containing vaccines. You know, the aluminum is a neurological and immunological. It causes neurological and immunological damage, and it's in the hepatitis B vaccine. It's in the DTaP or pertussis vaccine. It's in the pneumococcal vaccine. It's in the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine, and it's in the hepatitis A vaccine. So infants are receiving multiple doses of these vaccines. It's a serious problem.
Question with mercury. Are there any vaccines that contain both mercury and aluminum?
At this time, no.
Okay. I wonder if there's a reason for that. When you are recommended by the CDC to have multiple vaccines at the same time, are there any cases where there's a mercury-containing vaccine and an aluminum vaccine in the same group?
Yeah, absolutely, because, like I said, the infants are receiving mercury-containing influenza vaccines. So at 6 months of age, infants are receiving mercury-containing influenza vaccines. And at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, infants are receiving aluminum-containing pneumococcal vaccines and DTaP vaccines and the hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and the HIP vaccines. So they're absolutely receiving mercury and aluminum. And so then we're getting back into what I discussed earlier. There was a study that was shown that by Boyd Haley, that Dr. Boyd Haley, showing the synergistic toxicity between aluminum and mercury. This type of mercury by itself, aluminum by itself is dangerous. Mercury by itself is dangerous,
right.
But when infants get it in combination, it's even more dangerous.
Right. One argument I've heard in favor of mercury is being the mercury in thimerosal is organic mercury, it's ethyl mercury. The Minamata tragedy in Japan was methyl mercury, and so some people have said that methyl mercury is toxic, but ethyl mercury not nearly as much.
Yeah, this is a smokescreen.
Right.
This is absolute nonsense. In fact, like I said, there's dozens and dozens of studies just on ethyl mercury, okay,
right.
The type of mercury that's found in vaccines, confirming that ethyl mercury is toxic. Ethyl mercury is dangerous. In fact, one of the studies in my recent book shows it went over to the Amazon. And it went into a rural community, and these scientists, they went into the rural community where they were fish-eating communities, where the children were eating a lot of fish that contained methyl mercury, and then they also went into an Amazon urban community where the children were going to school and were receiving ethyl mercury containing vaccines, and they compared the toxicity between the methyl mercury and the ethyl mercury, and they discovered that the ethyl mercury was more toxic than the methyl mercury.
Yeah, so, I think there's I did a little bit of research in this area, and I concluded that some papers say methyl mercury is more toxic. Some say ethyl is more toxic. But I think the reality is they're both extremely toxic. And to say that, like you say, there's just no scientific basis to say that ethyl mercury is not a health concern. Maybe we can move away from mercury and aluminum because there's just so many other issues with the vaccines, not that they're not important, but you talked about the influenza vaccine. Paper 73 in your book is, you summarize as, influenza vaccines are not effective in young children, safety data can't be trusted. Now, this comes from the Cochrane Institute, which is the world's leading evidence-based medicine institute, which is normally treated with a great deal of respect. So what is this review? I mean, Cochrane doesn't do their own research. They do reviews.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson heads up the Cochrane collaboration, and what they found was that there's no convincing evidence that influenza vaccines can reduce mortality, hospital admissions, serious complications, or community transmission of influenza. And this is just one of numerous papers confirming that the influenza vaccine is not very effective. But there's other more interesting aspects of influenza that I'd like to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is and the studies, and this is taken from the studies that are summarized in my book, and this has to do with heterosubtypic immunity, okay?
You're gonna have to explain
several
that
studies,
term.
Yeah, it's a fancy term for something known as cross protection. So here's what happens, okay? And this is a bit borne out by the studies, and I'm going to summarize it in my own words,
right.
Summarize the process. So that what they found was that when you get vaccine. When somebody receives an influenza vaccine 2 years in a row, they're significantly more likely to be hospitalized when a pandemic strain comes along.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what happens with influenza. Influenza is a very mutable virus. So what that means is it mutates pretty often, pretty easily. And the mutations are usually small, so that the whatever strain is endemic this year, and endemic is a fancy word meaning the disease is sort of floating around in society, in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that when you go out into society, you're going to be exposed to whatever influenza strain is out there this year.
Right.
Now, if you have a healthy immune system, you're not going to even realize that you've been exposed to it because you're not going to contract it. You're not going to get sick. Okay. Now, what happens when you get exposed to that germ is that you gain cross protection to future strains. So when the influenza virus mutates the following year and the year after that, you have gained protection against these other mutations. But when you're vaccinated on a regular basis, when you receive the vaccines, the vaccine is preventing you from gaining that cross protection, from gaining heterosubtypic immunity, so that when you're exposed to a pandemic strain, and a pandemic strain is a strain that mutates, it makes a big jump. So, for example, what happens is the influenza virus will mutate a little bit 1 year, then mutate a little bit the next year, mutate a little bit the following year, and it'll do this for 15, 20, 25 years. And a lot of people will have cross protection because they're not vaccinated and they've been exposed to the endemic strain. Mm-hmm. But about every 20, 25 years, there's a big jump where the mutation is large and a lot of people don't have any real protection against it. This is what happened, for example, back in 1918, 1919 with the Spanish influenza. And it affected a lot of people because they didn't have a real protection against it. But the studies that I've summarized in the book have absolutely confirmed that people that are vaccinated, that receive a seasonal influenza vaccine, are actually statistically significantly more likely to end up with a very severe case that can be can border on inducing fatalities if they receive these seasonal vaccines when a pandemic strain comes along. But people that do not receive the seasonal vaccine are protected, more protected when a pandemic strain comes along.
So this is what is the importance of the flu vaccine to the CDC? Because it seems, you know, I've seen newspaper articles saying, you know, this year's flu vaccine is useless. You know, there's been quite a bit of criticism, even leaking into the mainstream press, which is normally pretty tight-lipped about problems with vaccines. But the CDC seems to see this as their flagship.
Well, again, I believe that the CDC, if you look, you're going to ask that question, and most rational people that believe that the CDC is an institution designed to be concerned about the health and the welfare of our citizens, you're going to ask that question, and and you're going to expect a rational answer. But if you understand that there's a revolving door between the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry, and that the CDC, like I had discussed earlier, is really a marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industry, then it'll make more sense. You'll understand that the CDC's interest, why they push these false statistics, they'll say things like 36,000 people die every year from influenza, which is total nonsense. I've gone to the National Vital Statistics, which is put out by the CDC, and you'll see that on an average year, you'll have anywhere from 700 to 1,500 people that have actually died from influenza, and these are people that usually have pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, I mean, the 30,000, I actually was once upon a time talking with a guy named Peter Doshi who wrote some articles.
Yeah, I know Peter Doshi. Yeah. He's written in the British Medical Journal.
Right, right. So what he found was that what the CDC was doing is they were looking, there's a higher death rate in the winter than in the summer. And so they would look at the difference in the death rate between the winter and the summer, and they'd ascribe it all to influenza, and that was the 30,000 people, which is the most incredible piece of sleight of hand that I've ever heard of in my life, to just go to a simple statistic like that and just like grab those numbers and say, those are ours, those are influenza, and because of this, you need to get vaccinated.
There's no scientific evidence that the influenza vaccine is protecting our population from fatalities. Okay, the studies show just the opposite, mm-hmm. and so the CDC is putting out a lot of false information, and they're simply out to promote and increase vaccination rates.
Right. And
I'm actually working on a second edition of a second volume of Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, and I've just completed a chapter on Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Right, which is paralysis.
It's paralysis that takes place after receiving the influenza vaccine. And a lot of the studies are showing that there's an excess of Guillain-Barré associated with the influenza vaccine anywhere at the rate of from 1 to 10 additional cases per million people. Now, you might think that's a small number. You might think, well, what's one or two cases per million? But think about this. The United States produces over 150 million doses of influenza vaccine annually, okay? Right. So even at a rate of two excess cases of Guillain-Barré per million people, that's 300 additional cases of paralysis in otherwise healthy adults. So you basically have healthy adults that are told to take an influenza vaccine, they get this vaccine, and they are now paralyzed. Okay?
Right, and so they are a huge burden on society. And, I mean, I don't want to say that, we shouldn't be looking after these people. We should be, but it's unnecessary. I mean, we should be looking after disabled people, but we shouldn't be disabling people just to make ourselves feel better because we then look after them.
Well, not just that, but these people have their quality of life is horrendous now.
Right.
They they've been misled. They were not given informed consent. And I'm not about telling people what they should or should not do. What I do is two things. I present information so that people can make informed decisions, and I am a staunch advocate against mandatory vaccines so that people are free to accept or reject vaccines. And these people, these adults, these senior citizens that are being told to get these influenza vaccines and are being told that it's perfectly safe are being misled. They're being lied to. They don't have access to informed consent because they're uninformed, because the CDC and the FDA and the health authorities are not informing them of the honest risk-to-benefit ratio. They're not telling them that if you get this influenza vaccine, there's going to be potential trade-offs, that a certain percentage of you that get this vaccine may become paralyzed.
And it's not just them. I mean, I think the mainstream media is totally on board with vaccines. The only time they talk about people who have any concerns about vaccines, they call them anti-vaxxers, and they allude to the fact that they're highly religious or have other irrational beliefs. They don't want to talk about people with scientific concerns about vaccines.
Well, there's a reason for this. Bobby Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr., mm-hmm. in his research, he discovered that the mainstream media receives 70% of its income from the pharmaceutical industry. And so they're not going to present any information that can put their income at risk. And that's why the mainstream media stifles any kind of a discussion about the true risk-to-benefit ratios of vaccines.
I think it's part of the reason, but I also think it's a bit more subtle in that most journalists are not scientists. They're arts students. They don't understand science. They don't have an ability to critically analyze this research. Doctors and scientists are basically put on a pedestal in our society, and journalists are deathly afraid of saying something and then getting ripped to shreds by these much more important people in society. So I think the status of doctors and scientists in society, their status to the point where they cannot be criticized, this new religion where they have the same authority as the Pope. What they say, if they have a PhD or an MD, must be true. That a doctor who studied, didn't study infectious diseases very much in university, still has a right to tell you that vaccines are necessary and safe and effective.
Until a medical doctor speaks out about vaccines, and then he's a quack.
Right.
He or she's a quack, yes. Or at least presented as a quack, and presented as a medical doctor that shouldn't be listened to. So doctors are put on these pedestals and are told we should listen to these doctors until these doctors begin to speak out about vaccines. And I do want to mention that Dr. Shira Miller is a medical doctor who started a nonprofit foundation called Physicians for Informed Consent. And she's got dozens of doctors from around the world who have joined her organization who are absolutely opposed to mandatory vaccines.
Right. Okay, we're unfortunately starting to run out of time. I've hardly even scratched the surface of this book. I just want to talk a little bit about my impression of your book. This is not a normal book where you sit down and you read page one and then you go through to the end. It's a categorized groups of papers on mercury, on aluminum, on the measles vaccine, different things like that. So it's much more of a reference book than it is, like a novel or something. But I think for people who definitely have some questions, who are on the fence, this is a great place to go when somebody tells you, you need to be, your kids need to be vaccinated for measles, otherwise you're going to spread measles to the rest of the school. You have a paper that says measles can be spread from fully vaccinated people to other fully vaccinated people. There was an outbreak in New York City in 2011, for example, which sort of addresses that criticism. But in the few minutes we have left, are there some other big issues you'd just like to touch on, or some other important things?
Yeah, I want to just mention that natural infections, a lot of people are afraid of these diseases, and many of these diseases are nothing to be afraid of. There's an entire chapter in there on natural infections and cancer, where numerous studies have confirmed again and again that when you contract measles, mumps, rubella, and or chickenpox in childhood, these offer you protective benefits. They've shown that people that catch these diseases in childhood are less likely to develop various types of cancer in later life. There's trade-offs. When you get these vaccines, they prevent you from getting these natural benefits that you get when you catch the wild disease.
You also have chapters on vitamin A and measles, vitamin D and influenza, and diet is, I don't think, is understood very well by medical doctors.
Well, the World Health Organization has actually come out with several studies, and these were studies that have gone back a few decades, where they've acknowledged that when you get high dosages of vitamin A, you are protected against the complications and death associated with measles. Vitamin A is very significant with measles.
Right, and that's probably why measles deaths had almost vanished in Western countries by the early 1960s, when the first measles vaccine came out. I believe it was the late 60s before any significant number of people got vaccinated. The vast majority of the reduction in deaths from measles occurred before any vaccine was available, and probably had to do with better understanding of diet in Western countries.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I discussed that in some of my papers, where in third world nations, even if you vaccinate, they've got, right now in third world nations, they've got upwards of 95% vaccine coverage rates, meaning that for all the vaccines that they recommend, all the children in those third world nations have received those vaccines, yet infant mortality rates refuse to drop. The only way that infant mortality rates will drop is when you go into those nations and you clean up the sanitation, you provide clean water, you provide proper nutrition for these children, and you also have to have good access to medical care for emergency care.
Basic medical care. A lot of people die from infected wounds basic medicine, as opposed, it seems like medicine either wants to do, let's vaccinate a million people, or let's do a heart transplant on one person, but there's something in between where medicine is actually very effective at improving people's lives. But
there are
it doesn't
too many
seem to want to deal with that.
There are too many trade-offs with vaccines to mandate them. That's the important point to remember. There are too many trade-offs. When you take a vaccine, there is a high risk that you will have a serious adverse reaction. And because of that, it is unconscionable to mandate mm-hmm. vaccines. Absolutely, everyone must remain free to accept or reject vaccines. And the other one thing I did want to mention
yes.
is that my book has been very successful about in terms of moving doctors, medical doctors, to become less aggressive and assertive in pushing vaccines. When medical doctors read my book, I'm hearing back from parents that the doctors have backed off on pushing the vaccines on.
I mean, this seems like a lot of parents might say, well, gee, I'm not going to read, you know, even the abstracts of 400 papers. But it seems like if you have a doctor saying your child needs vaccine X, that if you can read up on the, you know, a dozen or 20 papers and educate yourself and go in with the book, that's probably the best defense that you're going to have.
Well, you know, look, if the information is out there for any parents, that's my goal. My goal is to provide parents with documented evidence of problems with vaccines to counterbalance the all of the information out there that's being presented by the pharmaceutical industry, the CDC, the FDA, and the World Health Organization, and other health authorities, so that they can then begin to make informed decisions. And so parents can decide how much information is too much or too little, but the information is now available so that parents are capable of making informed decisions.
And that should be a very good thing, informed consent for all medical procedures for yourself and for your children. Neil, thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate the time that you've shared with me and my listeners.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to share this important information with others.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 152 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.